Finally, we should get started. So ladies first. Okay, Sajib, you want to start?
Yeah, why not?
Go ahead.
So, actually, for everybody, so we did a work on Storm. That's for the balancing I/O between different storage clusters, and you have database on top of it, and you have different tables, and you want to balance the I/O between all those storage clusters, and you want to move the database object efficiently across all the storage nodes so that your average I/O becomes better. So I want to somehow extend this work to the virtualized data center.
So this existing work is like load balancing for different nodes?
Yeah. So I want to extend this work for the virtualized data center. So in virtualized data center, you remember that. So in data center servers, data center guys, they have different servers. And you have all those virtual machines across different. So for example, you have virtual machine A that's being hosted by machine A. And you have virtual machine B that's being hosted by machine B. So the problem is that when all the virtual machines are in the same server, or some of the virtual machines that's consuming more resources are on the same server, your overall resource utilization becomes a bottleneck. So there should be some efficient algorithm so that we can distribute the virtual machine to different physical server so that your overall performance improved. So that's the work I want to propose. And so for virtualized environment, there is the technique that VM migration of virtual machine that you can efficiently use on runtime. So there is live migration option in Xen also. So you can just migrate one virtual machine running on physical host A to another physical host B without disrupting other virtual machines. So, but this work, if we can come up with a systematic algorithm to distribute this, to migrate the virtual machine to different physical machines not just manually, if there's kind of automation or there's kind of a systematic process for migration of virtual machine across different servers, that would be very good for data center servers, I guess.
So what are your thoughts? What do you guys think?
Yeah. So I have a question regarding the VM migration. So you're assuming that you have the VM, the memory in one location and then the storage in another location, right? You have a sort of...
In migration technologies, the one thing you have to remember that the storage should be in the network at a storage.
Okay.
So the machine... So all the machines should have, they can access the root file system.
Okay,
of the virtual
machine. Yeah. I was like, okay, then it's very complicated to migrate if it's not like that. So yeah.
This is basically data migration.
It's the entire VM migration, actually.
But
the bottleneck comes from different aspects. So bottleneck comes from network bandwidth utilization, skewed network bandwidth, or too much processor utilization. So for example, one machine is fully utilized in terms of CPU, but the other machine is not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better if we can move one virtual machine from physical host A to the physical host B, so that the overall...
So yeah, are you able to distinguish which VM is using which type of resource?
That is not hard to...
I mean, what is the bottleneck of a particular VM?
Yeah, that's not hard to find. So if we can monitor all those things from domain zero, for example, the CPU utilization or the network utilization, it's not hard to find.
But wouldn't this also depend on the workload? Like, you may have one VM which is the bottleneck, and the other may not have any traffic to it. So you're saying basically move some of this from here to the other VM?
Not
VM.
The physical host.
The physical host. Move the... But wouldn't that depend on the workload? Like, wouldn't it change? Isn't there a possibility it could change?
Depends
or
on...
keep changing?
Thing is that we don't care about what's running in the virtual machine. We are just sitting in the domain zero, the administrator.
Yeah, but wouldn't the workload change so much that it, you know, changes the way the resources for the VM are being used? That's the reason you transfer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the traffic on the resources, right?
Exactly.
So wouldn't that traffic depend on the workload?
Thing is that our goal should be to improve the application throughput in turn, and also to minimize the overall utilization, average utilization of all the nodes, physical nodes.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have, so I don't think the, so as long as the throughput doesn't decrease, it's not our problem.
Okay.
Meera, can you repeat your question?
So my question is that, okay, so when do you do this migration?
When I found that, so for example, the administrator could set some specific parameters. Say, for example, okay, this mesh physical host A is utilized, cannot be utilized more than 90% of the CPU.
Okay.
Some CPU should be.
Right. So this CPU utilization depends on the workload.
Yeah, it should depend on the workload.
So there could be times when the CPU utilization is less than 90 or when it's.
Yeah, depending on that, we will change the configuration also.
Right.
So, for example, if the VMs are not issuing any I/O or not processing any CPU or not utilizing any CPU, then the average inflation of that physical host will decrease, right?
Right. And then you do the transfer.
Then in that case, we won't do the transfer if the average.
No, if the CPU utilization is say less than greater than 90%.
Yeah, we will find out some
transfer.
VM which is
some threshold, then
yeah.
Then you would do the transfer. But this utilization depends on the workload.
Utilization depends on the workload. Yeah, but then what's the problem?
So if the workload keeps changing,
mm-hmm.
then you do the migration and then it could drop below 90%, even if you don't do the migration. Maybe it's just like a transient above 90%.
Yeah, but for example, the thing is that we don't do migration all the time. We do migration only, for example, after 1 day.
Okay, so is there some profiling component, right?
Profiling component going on, so it will determine that, okay, this typical of this is
okay.
a problem.
Okay.
Then this will find that, okay, this virtual machine is actually utilizing most of the resources.
Okay.
So we should move this to another physical host B.
Okay.
That's less.
One problem I could see is that what happens if you have two VMs that are on two different physical hosts,
uh-huh.
but they are actually interacting with each other, sending messages and some that sort of thing. And if you put them on the same physical host, then actually you will be increasing the overhead, right? Because since they're interacting, you would have to context switch one from one VM to the other so you can handle one message and back and forth, right? So that could
yeah,
be a
I
problem.
Yeah, but the point here is that the throughput should not decrease when you do the migration, right? So the throughput is going to decrease after the two VMs interacting with each other on the same host. Then you wouldn't do the migration to that host.
No.
Or is it just the CPU utilization that you
No, there are different parameters.
Different parameters.
For instance, if you have one VM that has a high CPU utilization and one that has high I/O demands, and you put them together, and then you would use more of the physical host.
Right, but it's
interesting. Actually, I didn't think about that. It is interesting.
So, George, can you repeat your question? Yeah, so if you have two VMs that are interacting with each other, let's say a client and a server, right? But they're on different physical hosts, right? And they have, let's say they have a lot of communication between those client server applications. But this one, let's say the client, the bottleneck is CPU, and the host, the bottleneck, the server, the bottleneck is I/O, for instance. Then you say I can put them on the same physical host. But the thing is that given their interaction, right, they have some causal dependency between them, then you would actually introduce a bigger overhead,
right.
because you would have to context switch one VM and another just to handle small operations.
causal dependency would exist regardless of where the machines actually reside.
Yes, yes. That dependency will exist. I agree with that. But my point is that probably if you put them on the same VM, the overhead caused by
same
that
machine,
on the same physical host, then the overhead caused by that causal dependency would actually increase.
That part
that
I
depends,
don't agree
actually,
with.
That depends on the workload. It depends on the average time the workload takes to service and effect.
The causal dependency would exist even if they are across two different machines and they are communicating with each other.
Right, but what he's saying is in addition to the causal dependency, the overhead due to that, there would also be an overhead for context switching.
Context switching would exist even if they were sitting in two different machines. It's just that the context switch targets would be different, let's say. And if there is causal dependency, that means that there is blocking, that means there is context switch. Whenever you have any such dependency, because physical host will not be idling its CPU. So let's say the server is waiting for a client to contact it, then the VMM will actually context switch out the server because the server does not have any job to do, regardless of where the client is. So in fact, I think that it is better to put two machines that are communicating with each other on the same physical host, as long as when they put together do not create another resource bottleneck, which is different than if they were, you know, residing separately.
But then how can you assure that they even don't create
them? Well, you cannot put like two IO-intensive workloads in the machine on the same physical
host. For instance, if server and client are both network intensive because they are residing on two separate machines, if you put them on the same physical machine, then you don't use the network card anymore. So you can optimize some part of the communication by using more native communication.
But is that true? If they share memory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
they do even bit flipping of higher pages.
Yeah, so I just wanted to sort of say that when you have causal dependency, you would have blocking, and when you have blocking, you would have context switches. So the point being that it does not really matter where the machines reside, together or not, there would still be the same degree of context switch. At least that's the way I see it. So Sajeev, I think you have identified a very hard problem.
Mm-hmm.
It is an important problem, and
but I guess
but
it's
when
somewhat very similar to the work we did in Storm. Only in this case the parameters are huge. It's not a single parameter.
I am not saying that the problem is not a good problem. I'm saying that it is a hard problem. Doesn't mean that we should not be working on it. But at the same time, what I would encourage you to do is, because the virtual machines community has been looking at this problem, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And what you might want to do is identify all the pieces of related work that might exist, even from 4 years ago. So
okay.
You want to look at stuff in the last four to, I would say, even go back until 6 years in all the systems conferences and see what people have been proposing in this space. Because data centers are already being virtualized and already are virtualized. So which means that they have to deal with this problem, which means that people probably did some work researching these problems, and I would not be surprised if there has been some initial work along these lines. The problem is hard, so that's why I do not expect that. I would be surprised if there is a complete solution that addresses all aspects of this problem. So there may be still some work left to do, maybe a lot of work left to do. But before we are able to say that, well, this is what we want to do next, there are two things that need to happen. One is the related work investigation, and second is some kind of an initial, let's say, idea that solves this problem and say, okay, this is our approach, and why is it reasonable? What are the challenges in implementing such an approach? That sort of stuff. So I would encourage you to think along these two directions to make your idea more viable. But it does seem interesting, and it is an important problem. It is not a problem that's entirely novel in its statement. So the novelty for us would lie in the approach. And that is why it is very important to look at what's already out there and see what are the shortcomings of the existing approaches.
I think the migration itself may not be novel, but why you have to do it and when you
need to do it. No, migration technology is not
right,
novel.
But when you need to do it and why you need to do it.
Why you need to do it.
You know, what parameters you consider and how you reduce the overhead.
That is true. And if you want to take a comprehensive view of the whole load balancing issue across all resources, then you might also want to not preclude migration of data. So, for instance, if you see that, well, there is, you know, there is a disk which is or a SAN device that is actually a resource bottleneck. Regardless of how much migration you would do of the VMs, it is not going to resolve a bottleneck which resides elsewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is important to model and state the problem and formulate the problem in a comprehensive way, taking into account all the resource properties and where all the bottlenecks might lie. But it is an important and interesting direction. Yes. Yeah, and what Meerup pointed out about transience, I think it's pretty important to address. If there is, you know, transient workload that is going to go away after a short period of time, then maybe it is not a good idea to migrate. So, yeah, those sort of things, the stability of the system has to be addressed.
I guess the idea is to be to when to decide for migration, right?
Right, because we're going to do a load balancing here, right? Load balancing for different resources.
Yeah, and we are not doing load balancing all the time, right?
Right, but there are also recent research on, in some cases, you need to actually unbalance the load, depending on the workload.
Unbalance the load?
Yes, because balancing may not necessarily be good all time. So you should probably look into some papers. Let's talk about
that. So, yeah, what would be the reasons to unbalance
the load? Well, the reason depends on the arrival rate of the IOs and the amount of time required to finish a request. And
so you mean probably if you unbalance, then you will lose sequentiality and stuff like that?
No, if you unbalance, then...
Sorry.
Okay, you have...
If you balance, you will lose sequentiality. And by unbalancing, you will gain sequentiality.
I can think of one reason why you might want to unbalance workload. I want to hear what Meera has to say.
Well, not only that, it also depends on... If you have different nodes, then you have... Like, for instance, well, if your job requires really short time to complete, then in those cases, I guess, balancing wouldn't help, because you would unbalance the workload and further create more overhead than if the job is balanced.
So you're unbalancing...
Oh, wait, I haven't read much on why you need to unbalance, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is before you attack me.
No, I just want to understand. I'm not attacking.
Yeah, no. I haven't read up much on, you know, why I'm balancing, but I can read it up and we can talk about that.
Yeah, one simple reason that I can think of why you might want to unbalance the workload is to save power. So if you use only a subset of the machines, then you can power down a whole bunch of machines and save power.
No, it's not just the power, it's also the throughput that could decrease if you balance the workload.
Uh-huh.
In some cases. But
so, I mean, for instance, I can think of the scenario that we talked about earlier. If you co-locate communicating services, then perhaps you can improve throughput rather than spread them out across two machines.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if there is a causal dependency that when the client is running, the server cannot run, and vice versa. So that sort of stuff you might benefit from co-location rather than spreading them out. Yeah, but so I guess certainly makes sense to think more along this direction.
I think I need to do the research.
You need to do the background work. Yes, now. Okay. All right, so who wants to...
So which are the other conferences that you go to that publish this kind of work? I mean, other than OSPI?
There is a conference called VEE, that's right. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah,
you certainly want to look at that. You want to look at OSPI, SOSP, Unix Technical, all the usual suspects, and what else? Autonomic computing, perhaps?
ICAC.
Yeah, ICAC. Because this is all about autonomics, right? So
probably even architecture conferences.
Yeah, you're right. So ASPLUS maybe, ASPLUS, HPCA.
Okay.
Yeah.
NSC, possibly.
Supercomputing. Yeah.
It has been supercomputing.
So I remember seeing some papers with the title which says like something like resource management in a virtualized data center, something like that. So I think the virtualized data center is a keyword that you might want to take a look at.
And if you find one relevant paper, you can always look at the references and see what are the conferences.
Yeah, so this is good. It seems promising.
Why me?
Well, go ahead.
Yes, Sajib, you're saying something?
So another work I was kind of thinking, but it's very intuitive actually. So I have seen some work illustrating that optimizing network performance in Xen or something. So what you do is that first use OProfile or XenOProfile as the OProfile version for Xen, to understand where is the performance or most of the time in network I is being utilized. So can we just do the same kind of work in storage for IO in disk IO? So I guess the one of the suggestion is that if we can export some of the higher level functionalities to the domain zero, even if the underlying network card is not supported for that, you can achieve a higher performance in terms of network IO.
Right, scatter-gather DMA.
Scatter-gather DMA or mainly scatter-gather DMA. So can we just say some kind of similar kind of works in storage IO or disk IO?
Yeah, I mean, at first thought it does seem like something.
Actually, what I was thinking, or what I was looking at in the conferences, the people are saying that many work have been done in for virtualization, many work have been done in case of CPU utilization or memory utilization or memory efficient memory utilization, but less work is being done in network and very less in disk space, in virtualized disk environment.
That's true.
No, now some people have started working on the network performance, virtualized network performance, improving.
The thing is that probably what happens is that most of the time they're connected by NAS, right? So you have your VMs in one location and your storage in a different one. And probably they use some, I don't know, big storage solution. I mean, it's harder to have context information about IO requests. I don't know, that's my guess.
I think what we need to do, certainly, which is important, and I don't believe that the storage community is looking at this problem deeply yet, but eventually they will have to, is to understand IO architecture in virtualized environments and to see what, for instance, if I'm using a NAS, then I have some iSCSI based device, but how is this iSCSI device connected to a VM? And what is the data path through the VMM that an iSCSI connection would have to take? How does data flow? And if there is a way to reduce some of the data movement or data copying inside the IO path and to improve those aspects. And I think what we need to look at are things like, for instance, VMFS, the virtual machine file system, and VMware virtual machine file system, and also look at Xen to see whether Xen, if there is support, for instance, for primitives like scatter-gather PMA for virtualized block devices, if you're using virtual block devices, and alternatively, if I'm going to use iSCSI, then I'm using a network connection, then how does that work in a virtualized environment?
So there are two components, right? I mean, and I think they're both very correlated, right? When you consider network IO, there's the IO backend and the network front end.
Right.
So I think you have to, I mean, if you come up with something, it has to take into account both things. Right. So what you're saying is that currently they're only analyzing the.
Actually, what?
But you meant network between. I mean, yeah, network traffic in between.
Actually, the network path, I would rather say. So all they're working before the physical component. So how the network traffic or network transfer or receive traffic is being handled for a virtual machine, and what is the transfer path or receive path? And what the OCO file does is that there is one paper from the EPFL group.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very popular group in this kind of work. So what they do is that they first use OCO file to understand where the most of the timing is being spent in the network IO file. And then they figure out, okay, most of the time is spent in the Xen itself, in the VMM context.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could improve some of the components in the VMM itself, so we can reduce a lot of transfer time or receive time.
So, for instance, if you have a virtual device that is capable of scatter gather DMA, then instead of issuing multiple requests, one per page, or then you could actually send vectors of IOs to at a single instance to the VMM, and then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the domain zero will do all of them together in parallel, maybe, and then send all the data at once instead of having to do this in a synchronous and blocking mechanism. So
yeah, but that's at the back end, right? At the storage back end.
This is about network.
Yeah,
this is about the network interface. So. In network cards, right, today, you can do large I.O. using scatter-gather mechanism. But virtual network devices are not capable of that.
Mm.
So you want to make them capable of that sort of stuff and perhaps use direct access to the device in some sort of protected mechanism. So you don't have to go through domain zero for each I/O operation.
I guess now in, even in Zen you can have the direct device. You can.
Yeah, so I think those are some of the improvements that are being made, and I think for us to stay competitive, we have to understand the cutting edge technology first and understand it really well before we start proposing some solution.
I was thinking that will be the network IO, will be the storage IO, disk IO will be different from network IO in this case?
I would say it depends. For instance, if you're using something like an iSCSI front end to a NAS device, so the front end is on network. So you're going through a network connection. On the other hand, if you're using a virtual block device, then maybe your concerns would be different. So even addressing just simple or understanding the simple differences between these two mechanisms of connecting to some backend storage would be valuable. I don't think people have really explored it.
I would be different on that.
Yeah, so I think that would be certainly worthwhile exploring. But first we need to understand exactly what the technology is and understand how iSCSI would work.
How actually the disk IO in virtual environment works is difficult.
Yeah, how virtual block devices work, I think that we understand to some extent, but how do iSCSI connections work in a, you know, because now you have virtualized network connection,
mm-hmm.
How does that impact performance? I think those sort of things
are
important.
Yeah, but I guess that the only one that sees the virtualized network, the iSCSI connection will be the VMM, right? And the other ones just see a normal.
What if the iSCSI endpoint is inside the VM? That's a possibility.
That's a possibility, yes.
That's a possibility. So, because these are all machines, and I could have iSCSI.
Then it would be the network driver, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
The question is, what is the common usage out there? Maybe people have developed some rules of thumb just by observation. Say, okay, let's deploy it this way and see what the performance looks like. And then they realize, well, this iSCSI inside the VM is really bad for whatever reason. They said, okay, let's do iSCSI inside domain 0 or inside the VMM and let's see how it goes. So, but then you had to sort of export some kind of block device to to the VM. So they're using virtual block device there, which gets translated into iSCSI. So yeah, I think understanding the data path of in a virtualized environment for storage I/O is, I agree that it's an important problem. But for doing that, like I said, we have to look at what are the rules of thumb that people have been proposing and advocating. For instance, VMware, then these guys will have some suggestions or rules of thumb to say, okay, if you want to virtualize storage, do it this way. And if we understand that, I think that would help us.
I remember some time ago I was researching into VMFS, but I couldn't find much more on that. Yeah, much information.
So the virtual block device in VM virtual machine, so the front end, does it have those kind of functionalities like command queuing or something?
It all depends on the implementation of the virtual block device. As you can imagine, right? So you can have very primitive virtual block devices that do not support command queuing. And you can have others like SATA-like virtual block devices which would support command queuing. I do not know what is the...
How does command queue help in the overall application throughput and the disk IO?
It helps because... So assume that you are a VM,
mm-hmm.
and if you issue only one I/O request at a time in a blocking fashion, although you have a queue of pending I/O requests, since the VM does not see the actual device,
mm-hmm.
it may not be issuing the request in the right way. And especially in the presence of multiple VMs, there is multiplexing going on inside the VMM. So the VMM is the only entity that has global knowledge. And if the VM were to just send out all the I/O requests in its queue to the VMM can do a much better job because it has global context. So a command queuing enabled virtual block device would probably do better than a virtual block device that does not support such queues. Because domain zero would then have more opportunity to do its optimization. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Actually, that's my more proposal, that rather than exporting all the functionalities or all the responsibilities to the VMM, if we can do let VM do some of the job and then process this in a better way so that VMM can later fine-tune it. So I guess it would be better for the virtual storage environment.
Yeah, so I agree there is potential. I think of the two directions, I think the two directions that you have brought up. The first is the dynamic resource management in the virtualized data centers. I think that's a known problem, and it's a hard problem. So the novelty there would lie in the solution.
So the algorithm will come out eventually, possibly.
Algorithm, yeah, whatever it is that you want to call it, the overall, the approach and the solution, that would be the novelty. In the second problem, I think the novelty is in identifying the problem itself, because where does, understanding the IO path for storage in a virtualized environment, all the various possibilities, and then saying, okay, these are the good rules of thumb, or something like that, is not just based on observations, but based on scientifically sound reasoning for why you are proposing a certain approach as opposed to a different approach, and say, okay, here are some improvements that can be made to the IO path, similarly to what the networking guys have been doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there we have possibly a novel problem itself, which is sort of the silver bullet. It's always difficult to find novel problems. But you can find an existing problem and come up with a novel solution. That's the easy part. But if you find a problem which is completely new, I think it's much easier to get that published than to get a new solution to an existing problem published.
But I don't think that even the migration, with the use of migration technologies in VM, there are much worse than that. So utilizing.
I agree, because it's
because
a hard problem.
This is a new technology introduced.
Well, not in the research domain. In the research domain, VM migration has existed probably since 2001 or 2002. So since then, I'm sure people have looked at how to use that technology to address this really hard problem that you described.
But actually, there is not any well-known paper for that, right? For example, any automated approach or something for migration of virtual machines.
Oh, probably that's
very hard. I think, it is a hard problem. And like I said, we need to go do more literature survey and see what exists out there. And unless we do a comprehensive survey, we cannot reasonably claim that we know what is out there and what people have already accomplished. Because in our lab, we haven't looked at this problem before. So I personally have not had much motivation to go and read up on that specific topic. Okay, so I think you bring up two very interesting problems. I would lean initially at least towards the second one that you described.
Okay.
Because, like I said, it addresses two novelties rather than one.
I also like the second one. It seems first more simple than the other one.
The second one, you say it's intuitive. Let me tell you that some of the best papers are really intuitive. So even if you say the approach is intuitive, I think it's, in fact, you have to look at it from positive way than a negative way.
Okay.
So don't think of an approach being intuitive as being a negative. I would say it's a big positive.
Someone here.
Okay.
You're laughing. Well, I don't really have a concrete idea. It's more how to deal with something that's there. So Remember the link I sent you guys about the summit that the kernel developers had,
mm-hmm.
where they discussed various problems?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they pointed out is that they want to see the future of SSDs as devices that are random access in both in terms of read and write, and that the dissimilarity in between reads and writes will eventually disappear and we will have very similar read and write access time, random read and random write access time. But they don't say that okay, someone's going to do this work, right? So my thought was okay, so why don't we just envision some IO mechanism to deal with that future, right? So current file systems and this scheduling algorithms are designed for this that are basically fast sequential and slow random access, right? So why don't we come up with a new battery of algorithms that best suits this type of devices, right? That accommodates for IO that, let's not say they are very fast at accessing, but are very similar with random access, just like memory, right? Or probably, of course, sequential is still a lot faster than random, but the thing is that the similarity is not as big as before.
The disparity is
not as big as before, right? So well, that's basically my idea. It's not something concrete. It's more like
a direction.
Yeah. That I don't know what you guys think about it.
But you're talking about like changing the interface of the SSD?
No, I'm not talking about changing the interface. I'm talking about changing the
okay.
algorithm, the whole mechanism. I mean, going from between file systems and descaling algorithms, I mean, all that, I think, has to change with this new variable introduced.
I think this is something that Lewis also mentioned to me earlier. Probably not in the ideas. It certainly is seems like a reasonable thought to say that, well, we have new devices, so let's rethink our file system and IO scheduling mechanisms for these new devices. And whenever there are new devices, there's always this discussion. So I think it's a very reasonable direction. So I guess one of the things that I don't know, I was reading somewhere, I'm not sure if this was a statement that was made by Linus or someone else, who basically said that, well, you probably want to wait for, let's say, 2 or 3 more years until the technology stabilizes, so you understand where the limits of the technology are.
Yeah. That was Linus?
Yeah. So someone forwarded, maybe it was the same article that you
read. Yeah,
it was the same article, yeah. So, and that's also reasonable, though, I mean, that is a statement that would be much more important for developers who are, you know, making changes into the OS. From a research standpoint, I guess we do not have any such restriction, though we have to be careful about what are the set of assumptions we are making about the future and say, okay, here's all the potential range of possibilities then. And then if it happens this way, then you want to go this way. If it goes in this other direction, then maybe you want to use a modification to the approach. So, and the fact that, or rather I should say the speculation that random reads, random access would be the same as sequential access or with very small disparity, at this point, it is not clear how much that would be eventually true. especially the random writes, I think what we are looking at is a possibility that random write performance can approach sequential write performance if you use some sort of logging mechanism. With the argument that cleaning is not as expensive as we described because of good random reads. So so I do see that there is, you know, the gap can reduce, but the overheads of such an approach has not yet been understood. You know, what are the limits of doing that sort of optimization? But yeah, I guess the speculation may be true to some extent, but we don't know to what extent. And that would really depend on the limits of the cleaning mechanism for writes. So yeah, I do agree that it's an important direction to pursue, and I think you know, like you pointed out, people have already been thinking about this direction.
So what changes can, what type of changes can you suggest to the file system or Kibler when SFC when you replace?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think current file systems are all based on the cylinder group idea, right? The cylinder group idea, yeah. So well, that's one change that it's very evident. Now you don't need to have that assumption. So you can have your file system behave in a completely different way, right? And actually, I think there's this one guy, I always forget his name, that Oracle hired him to make a new file system. I think it's called, I forgot the name of the file system. But Oracle hired him to make a new file system for Linux. And they are thinking that that would be the file system that actually is going to replace EXT3 in the next.
That's the ButterFS?
The ButterFS, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that, but I think it would be good for us to know a little bit more about that file system, and exactly what are the assumptions that underlie the file system.
Actually, it's very similar to CFS.
CFS.
Oracle
is doing a lot of virtualization stuff nowadays.
Yeah.
Because there are some work in progress, or after the OSDA workshop, there is a workshop there. They have some paper on IO virtualization.
So that it's a work in progress or a workshop paper?
Workshop paper.
Okay. Yeah, so for instance, that paper would be a very important paper to look at. And so yeah, send me a pointer to that one.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, in general, the SSD problem, I think, remains unsolved from an OS management standpoint. But it could also be that, well, regardless of what you do, how you manage the device, the performance is going to be the same.
Yeah, but I mean, my guess is it's not only considering SSDs as flash devices,
mm-hmm.
as they are currently, but I think in the future we will have different types of SSDs, and that and that probably this type of disk will be only used in the future for archival storage. Like, you have your external hard drive where you put all your things and it's just a backup device. And SSDs will be the main device in the machine, right? So why don't we optimize our machine to use that type of device? Because one assumption I think that is being made right now is that SSDs are just this device is based on flash, but that might not be the complete true, right?
That's true, yeah. That's a very good point. These guys, for instance, Fusion IO guys,
mm-hmm.
they are building a PCI Express based solid state storage, right? So it's just a PCI card
mm-hmm.
that you directly attach to your computer without having to go through a block interface. So you can access it like, at any granularity.
Okay.
So, and
ranging from byte to whatever, right?
Yeah. I don't know what is the smallest granularity.
Okay.
But the point being that the connection is different. You don't need to use a more primitive controllers. I mean, for instance, Serial ATA and IDE, these are all controllers that have been built for much slower devices. So why should we use, you know, a controller that was built for a much slower device with a much faster device? That is the argument behind what Fusion IO's architecture is. And I think there is also, I also ran into some presentation by these guys, video presentation from Fusion IO, right? You might want to take a look
at those presentations are normally publicity, so.
Not necessarily. I mean, some of them are reasonably technical. So, for instance, this guy has this guy called Robin Harris. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
Robin Harris is this blogger that who blogs exclusively about storage. So,
oh yeah. No,
yeah.
No.
So
it's like a storage module.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Storage.
Yeah.
So sometimes he has some reasonable articles. So, you know, and I think I found the Fusion IO video that was his interview of the CTO or something of Fusion IO. And so that interview was, I think, reasonable. I mean, it didn't go into a whole bunch of detail about the internal architecture of those devices, but basically the CTO was arguing why should you use PCI Express rather than SATA or SCSI or something like that. What are the advantages and so on. So I think we are at a point of evolution where things are changing and the state of flux. So the underlying interface eventually can be completely different than what we see today. But being in research, we always have to work with what exists and what are the potential future directions. Say, okay, if you assume that, then here's what you should be doing. If you assume the option B, then you should be doing something else. And so we have that sort of flexibility. But the real question is, well, everyone knows and understands that we need to potentially rethink OS design of storage management, but I guess no one really has argued for why a certain approach is superior to something that already exists. I
could clearly see some advantages of having smaller granularity IOs, right? For instance, now, I mean, most of the IOs operations are due to small things that, for instance, you have a page and you insert something in the middle and then you ship the rest, right? If you have smaller granularity IOs, you could just do a differencing thing, right? So now you could just write the difference and that would be it. And now it's the cost is much lower, right? So there is a big argument for that type of file system, I guess.
Yeah, that.
I think having this in there's a lot to explore in this direction that I guess a lot of people are working on it, but I mean probably from the architecture point of view. There's more work being done, and there are different problems than from the operating system point of view. And from the operating system point of view, at least not much has been published. That's my view also.
I think the community is still trying to understand these devices, the research community. The most recent paper was on the transactional flash.
Yeah, but for instance, in France, there are no papers about that.
There's no papers because the papers that were sent were not good enough. There were no new ideas, I would say, of the set of papers that we saw in the SAS submission.
But what kind of problems were there present?
They were talking about, for instance, there were some papers talking about hybrid storage between disk and flash, which I think is important, but the solutions that were being proposed were very sort of very, very, I would say, primitive and not not really backed by, you know, strong motivations based on real experiments. I think what for a paper in this space to succeed, we have to show that an actual implementation that is superior and performance that is superior to what we would have if you did not use this approach, right? And that did not exist in some of the papers. I would say most of the papers. There has to be, you know, the best paper, I think, in my opinion, is a paper that for papers like this is to motivate the design. Say, okay, why, with some initial experiment, say, okay, why does this new design make more sense than what exists? And then actually implement it and then validate that it in fact does make things better. So if we structure a paper along these lines, for something like a new file system design, then I think that would be high impact work. That wasn't part of any submission at all. For instance, looking at the Fusion IO architecture and seeing what is possible with that sort of device, because I mean, I was listening to that interview, and that guy made a lot of sense, because why would you retrofit an existing interface that was built for a much slower device and use it for a new device, a new technology, which is superior, right? So it just doesn't make sense to do it that way. And especially, they have a device that is much better. It is more expensive, but if you manufacture in high volume, then the costs also start going down. So it could be one direction which seems to be promising, and it seems like a valid assumption to make for a possible future scenario. Say, okay, if it did turn out this way, like the way Fusion IO guys are proposing or something similar, then how should file systems be designed? Or how should IO schedulers be designed? I think it is important to work. And I guess, Lewis, you have the exact same problem that you had to propose. Yeah, I think it is certainly worth exploring and spending more time on. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's good. So let's, Josh, do you have anything else, or should we?
No, just fine.
I have a suggestion. Maybe each of us should also put a summary of what we proposed on the wiki page. Let's say, you know, in the future, if we have to go back and refer to one of our sentences, we don't have to go through the input each time and see who's proposed what. It's also just a research statement when you need it in the future.
The recording and who's for that? Are we doing
it? No, but then once
yeah, but the recording is, I mean, it's very hard to go
long. It's hard to parse. I mean, if we know what exists in the recording,
yeah,
then we can
you
go
know,
and
you know,
look at it. But if we don't know what exists in the recording, then it becomes a problem. I sort of tried to summarize it in my description of the MP3, but...
Yeah, but it's still
think,
hard to find
yeah.
something specific.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah, I would encourage you to do that. I mean, we have the idea session page.
Yes, just put each of us.
Yeah. Let's do that.
It really helps in the research statement as well.
Oh, of course. I think we should read carefully about the transactional slash and the difference in each paper. Let's read this again.
Yeah.
Transactional slash and what? And different in each. That's in the third day we missed it.
Yeah. I did read the difference engine paper. The transactional slash only briefly, though. The difference engine paper was interesting.
Yeah. Actually, you have a couple of questions about the inspection question or the policies in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know that they implement in this transaction of Flash, what they do is to take advantage of the Flash characteristics and try to bring some primitives to allow transactions at the flash or at the device level. So instead of just having read this position in this block or write this block, they have write atomic, and they add write atomic, and also they add abort. Right? So it seems like in the flash you have all you now have all these transaction system, right? Where that is similar to the database, so you can, you know, do commits or try to do commits, and you can abort and so on, right? But you also have all these complications of if you abort this one, then you have to abort the next one that depends on this transaction and so on. So one of the questions for...
No, hold on. Transactions are atomic, right?
Yeah.
So they're self-contained. You don't have transactions depending on each other. You know, you have...
You're talking about nested transactions?
Right, I'm talking about nested transactions.
At least for journaling file systems, you don't have nested transactions.
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah.
And,
or...
Yeah, the thing... I don't know. The thing is that they... it seems like... All they are implementing all these systems of transaction that probably is too complicated for a file system because in the for instance in current file systems you don't have the opportunity to do an abort, for instance, right? Just if you crash, you reply what is in the log and you're done. But with this new what they propose, you have the opportunity to do abort and so on. So, well, I'm still thinking how that could be useful, but it seems like, you know, when Margot wrote her question, he said something like...
What question?
I don't remember the question, but that's not important. Things that she said something like, it's good that you are finally finding the transactional or the complete transactional file system, something like that. I don't remember well. So apparently it's important in the file system community to find a transaction, you know, a transaction complete interface that you guys are proposing. Right? So I don't know exactly how is that important, how is that useful.
There is also another paper, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
I think she has a previous work on that. On transactional file system, yeah.
There is, for instance, these guys at Stony Brook who have done some work on ACID file systems, which is full database transaction capability file system. And I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, there is... there will be a paper that will be also published in FAST 2009, which talks about this this topic.
Okay.
Or trying to remember if it got accepted or rejected. It was on the borderline, so I don't know if it's eventually made it or not. But yeah, I guess the program is available, so you can find out. But yeah, I think the point is that from an application standpoint, you might want to do some atomic operations, right? Like you want to modify two files, and within the context of a single transaction. So I have to say that really I don't have an answer to your question yet. I have to look deeper myself to understand why ACID properties are even relevant to file systems.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some work on building ACID file systems. So I'm sure that there are some fringe applications that probably depend on such properties.
But my guess is that when you are doing I think it's an interesting property to have because, for instance, suppose you're doing this big update to a file, and the file is spread into a whole bunch of places, right? So the file is fragmented. So if you do one transaction that you can either commit or abort and know what to do, it's better than to have small transactions, and if one fails, then you would have to see what part to where you have to roll back and all that things. I mean, I find it something that would be very useful. I mean, from the file system point of view, probably from the application, it would be transparent to the application, but from the file system point of view, I think it would be very useful to have transactions.
But why, I'm thinking sort of things here. For instance, what you're saying probably could also be solved with a snapshot. But for instance, it seems like the abort operation is a very complicated thing to have, or operation to have. So these guys of transactional flash, they have a lot of complications, and actually they have to design a new commit protocol and so on. And my problem was that, okay, you have all these complications, right? But you can actually make it a lot simple, a lot more simple. And it just support these journaling primitives, and you can get rid of several things. And probably you will have a better performance, and you also will have a more simple system, right, than having all these transactions. So I guess my problem is that I don't have a good motivation to have these tested processes in the
office. So one thing you might want to think of is that if you did not have journaling, but had something else like soft updates,
mm-hmm.
which is ordered updates to static locations.
Right.
Then having a transaction mechanism at the device would make sense. So I just say, okay, here's the transaction begin. Here are all the IOs that need to be part of the transaction. Here's the end of the transaction. The interface to the device and the abstraction or the design of the file system is simplified. So I don't need to go through a complex journal mechanism.
But
I also reduce the number of IOs, because I don't first write the journal and then do a checkpoint into the static location. Rather, I just write to static location.
Yeah, that's true. I understand that. But in that case, you don't have the abort, or you don't need the abort operation. Right? It's what I'm saying. It's just a simple journal mechanism.
It's not journaling anymore. It's a different mechanism. It's atomic updates. You don't use journaling. So it's much simpler. I do see your question about aborts. Why do we need aborts?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about the patches work, the
mm-hmm.
generalized file system dependency. So could it be that if I know, well, first this atomic, I mean, are there atomic operations that set up IOs that are dependent on others? And if I do both of them simultaneously, perhaps I have better performance. But if one of them aborts, then both need to abort or something like that.
Well, probably if you're doing prefetching, the abort could be useful. Right, because let's say you have this program that reaches two files, right? And you say, okay, let me prefetch both files. And if you see that it's starting to read one file, then you can just abort the other read operation. I mean, it's just a toy example, but I think...
No, but the abort is about the writes and the commits, right? The abort is that if you have a transaction in place right now, you abort and finish the transaction. Or abort the left. Well, anyway.
There may be possibilities where you have, for instance, like George mentioned, not necessarily prefetching, but a more generalized version of that, which is, well, I have to do one of two different operations, and I want only one of these. And as soon as the first one succeeds, the second one aborts. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a stretch of imagination to understand how it would be useful in a file system, but I can certainly design a file system which would use something like that. Right?
Yeah, I also I don't see what's crazy about it. Yeah, let's say, for instance, you either write to this location or to this location. That could be one example, depending on the disposition. Okay, fine, anyway.
All right, so Louis, since you started the discussion, do you want to go next?
Yeah, so I don't know, it's a very simple idea, and probably very related to the ABLE. So the thing is that it seems like there are many projects that are using this idea of mapping or remapping blocks, right, from one place to another. And we have several of them. In OSCI, there was one guy doing write offloading for performance.
Everest.
Those kind of projects. But it looks like, actually, I don't remember he mentioning how the consistency is handled. Remember that? No. How the consistency is handled, you know, if you have a shutdown or a crash and when you have it. Anyway, so the problem is that there are several projects that use this remapping, and you have this mapping, and you need to keep this consistency of all this, right? In case of crashes or in case of sudden power failure. So I was thinking that probably we should focus just one paper in having some efficient or some very, you know, think about it and have some kind of efficient mapping and try to do a generalized consistency mechanism to handle all this. That's one of the ideas. So, yeah.
Are you referring to persistent mapping?
Yeah, I'm referring to persistent mapping as well.
So we are doing that.
We're doing that, yeah.
Yeah,
so George, the current paper he's working on is all about generalized persistent data structures.
Yeah, it's actually it's more general than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me just make a short summary of the paper.
Okay.
So the idea is that we have these structures that we call containers.
Mm-hmm.
And a container, we have just a whole bunch of things, right? So now we have a small change to the malloc implementation. Now you have two types of malloc, the normal malloc and what we call a p-malloc for persistent malloc, right? And when you say that you have a persistent malloc, you actually store something within the container.
Okay.
So, and you have different, let's say, update policies for that container to be written to disk. The only additional thing that you need to do is that when you have a pointer inside a persistent structure that you want that to be marked as a pointer, you have to tell the application that there's a pointer at that location, because then when you store it and you read it back again, it might not load in the same location, so that pointer will be to garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you need to update also that pointer.
Mm-hmm.
Value. So, yeah, that's basically it. And then we also have this sort of log structure way of writing that to the file system, so it would be optimal. And yeah, and there are many, some things there that are...
We're writing to disk.
We're writing to disk, yeah.
And the other thing is the pointer at can potentially be also seamless with the compiler extension.
Mm-hmm.
Where
exactly.
Yeah, so if we can describe all the pointers and reprocess pointer at insertion,
mm-hmm.
then the developer doesn't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so George has been working on this for some time now.
Yeah.
We started during the summer with
mm-hmm.
Mike.
And this guy's working here.
I guess we should know more about what each of us is doing, right?
Yeah. I think that...
At some point we said we would have this presentation, right?
We would have weekly meetings where everyone...
Monthly presentations.
Monthly, yeah. Some kind of informal...
No, the idea was to also increase the communication...
Yes, for some reason I'm not being good at sustaining what I started. So we started off, I agree, we started off this weekly session, but somehow it didn't sustain.
No, not the weekly sessions. We also said we would have these formal presentations where we try to communicate in formal language about what we're doing once a month or something.
Yeah, I think that's important to do. Just like we have our idea sessions, we should have once a month status updates. So.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the projects, so at least we know what each of us is doing, so we don't reinvent ourselves.
I guess if somebody asks us what your club is doing, of course,
point them to me. No, that's not good. I think we should know more about what each of us is doing. Because, I mean, for instance, with the persistent data structures work, I think we had some really interesting breakthroughs, and that allowed us to actually solve this problem in a realistic and
I think very simple way, also.
Simple and also perhaps efficient way. At the surface level, we struggled for quite a bit to just understand what is the right approach to take with this problem. But I think now we are at a state where we are confident that the approach that we are taking is that not just reasonable, it's actually pretty close to the best approach that we can take. So, I mean, let's have this, we are doing this idea session second week, which will do the project updates every fourth week, so something like that, yeah? Is everyone in agreement with that suggestion?
Yeah.
And this time I'll try to enforce our monthly project updates. Okay, so Lewis, I guess I'm sorry we had to...
No, that's fine.
I'm
still thinking if that solves the problem. I think it does.
I mean, for instance, we have a persistent mapping, you don't have any problems. You just restore the mapping and you start as if nothing happened after the crash.
Yeah, but I was thinking a little bit.
Yeah, but the thing is that we also have different consistency policies. For instance, we can have one consistency policy that is always, write on update. So every time you make an update, you write. Or write a certain interval, write every X amount of
updates. That doesn't solve these interleaving cases we have in Borg and Nexus. But it's not part of the data structure itself, but more some side effect or something else. When we have a foreground operations of block A and we are reconfiguring or moving that block from one place to another, how we handle that foreground request? We stop it, we say read from this location, we say read from this other location.
Though one of the reviewers said, well, the answer is obvious. You should read, from the source, or you should write to the destination. And I guess, which is in a way true. I mean, if you look at it that way, it's true that if you want to read, you read from source. You write to destination. And in either case, that should work. But yeah, maybe there are some general problems to be addressed that are not straightforward. I can't pinpoint any. I mean, of course, we have so many problems when we worked on Borg. And we decided that, well, that's why we want something like Abel to be there, so that next time we don't go through the nightmare again. and that's the part of the persistent data structures work is all a consequence of what we learned during our work on Excess and Borg. Okay, so do you have anything else to suggest, or should we listen?
Well, I have something else. It's also very simple. The thing is that I like this idea a lot of Squid. Actually, I think it was a very, very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking of using also, because it seems
like...
Let me
summarize.
Oh, sorry.
Remember the paper in Aryadi database relational...
Yeah, Aryadi talked about it while we were at Wisconsin.
Okay. So the thing is that, you know, it seems like this is a very good idea of using of reading and using some external tool and probably that makes the process simple, right? So I was thinking that probably apart from SSDK, you also have the file system itself, the implementation probably could be kind of complicated, right? You have you need to handle some errors, right? You need to have some error policy. You need to have some structures. You need to keep some relation between these structures. And I was thinking of doing some kind of high-level language just for designing file system. I don't know exactly how, but you know, just about that. Something like you have this structure, this structure is related to this other one in some way, and you know, something like that.
There was a paper in FAST 2005, I think, from Ramsey's group.
Okay.
On that was titled A Logic of File Systems. And I think the goal of that paper was basically to do what you are suggesting.
Okay.
So you might want to take a look at that.
The
A logic of file systems.
Okay.
Though I haven't read the paper. But I was at the presentation and it seems like it addresses what you're suggesting.
Okay.
But there may be more to it because that work was never followed up.
Yeah.
From
probably this is a follow up. I mean that.
Yeah, it may be a follow up. So certainly that work formalizes file systems.
Okay.
The behavior of file systems, the specification of file systems. I don't think it proposes a language that can automatically generate new file systems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's even possible, but if it were possible, it would follow up to some extent the work that was presented in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we want to read up on that.
Okay, so
you're basically suggesting automatic generation of file systems, or at least in some way
of some high level.
Yeah. Seems like a dream. But yeah, I mean, no, certainly worthwhile to spend more time on. I don't see why not. Okay, so I guess Medha.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your ideas.
Yeah. So I was thinking that you know, system administrators and they usually configure systems. They just use the best CPU and the max memory system, and you know, just create a system based on some use. But most of these resources.
Can you repeat what did you just say? The system administrator choose the best CPU?
Well, I mean, they just use whatever is the current existing technology to create a system based on, you know, some heuristics, I guess. But the thing is, most of these resources may not be used. Like, for instance, if it uses a very high-end CPU and if the workload is IO-intensive, then the CPU is basically ideal. So that's like a waste of resources. Okay. So what if we create a tool where the system administrator can provide what are the requirements, you know, what would be the approximate traffic, the number of requests it requires for service per second, or whatever metric it requires to optimize. And then this tool would provide the parameters that are required to, you know, create such a system.
Give you.
And this can be further extended to make a self, not exactly a self-managing system, but this can be further extended to where this tool can be integrated with machine learning techniques. So based on the workload characteristics, based on what metrics you need to optimize for, it could provide what changes it could make to the system to keep the system deliver the same output.
So I have a question. So what would be the output of a
The basic tool would just give you the configuration of the system.
Like
how
what type of CPU, how
what
much memory.
How many disks you need if you want to create an array, how much memory you would need.
Okay.
What should be the disk sizes, what kind of disks, and so on.
I guess it's somewhat similar to the work that a dollar from 15 cells across platform management.
A dollar from 15 cents.
So this, what you're describing is a classic capacity planning problem. Is basically, if you want to, if a system administrator wants to purchase new hardware, and then what sort of hardware he should be purchasing. And so this is known as the capacity planning problem. And in fact, there's some work that I've done with a collaborator in Tokyo Research, IBM Tokyo Research Lab, and from a collaborator in Mexico that addresses this problem to some extent. And there's also a whole bunch of work that exists in this space. So the work that I'm talking about is still under review. So it's under review at a journal, but I can send you a copy of that paper. But the idea that we use is to create a model of the performance of the system, given either the target performance or the available resource properties and characteristics.
Right.
And so once you have this model, then you can say, okay, here's my target performance metric. Let me keep some of the parameters fixed and come up with a new value for a certain unknown parameter.
Okay.
So this domain of work does exist.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would say that there is, you know, the dollar from 15 cents is a paper that addresses this to some extent. But
yeah.
The problem is not yet comprehensively solved, and that's why people are still working on this problem. But I should say that the space is vast. And when we started off doing this work, we did not realize that. And we knew there was some work, but we didn't really understand how vast this space was.
No, the space is definitely vast because this won't just be addressing one metric. It will also contain other metrics as well. Like the capacity points and what kind of rate system do you want and what should be the resources for the rate system.
Yeah, so then the question
if
is,
you
do you want to...
Then what do you want to do? And also, this can be extended to use some machine learning techniques wherein if the workflow changes, it can make the required, suggest the required changes that have to be done to the system.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is to arrive at a model of the system performance given the workload characteristics and the resource characteristics. And once you have that sort of model, then you can make anything the variable. Maybe you can make, well, given all the workload and resource characteristics, what would be the target performance?
Mm-hmm.
Or given the workload and the target performance, what would be the resource characteristics?
Yeah.
Or given the, you know, the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So you can answer all these what-if questions, but the really hard part is how do you come up with a model?
Yeah.
And people have been taking a shot at coming up with these models,
part of what Sajeev is doing for one of his projects also falls within the same domain of understanding application performance in terms of workload characteristics and resource characteristics, and coming up with this sort of model that will predict the behavior or performance of the application. So this, what you're describing lies in that space of application modeling, capacity planning. These are just two variants of the same framework. Either you want to predict performance or you want to plan for, you know, do a capacity planning operation. But in either case, the starting point is the same, which is how do I model the performance in the first place? Yeah, so I would say that it is a hard path to go along, and out of experience. What Sajeev is doing is a little bit different because he wants to do it in a virtualized environment.
Right. Yes, so we can break it down into smaller parts and integrate it to that, if of course we choose to follow that path.
Yeah, I guess the dollar from 15 cents also based on virtualized environment.
Yeah, I guess so. But not, it doesn't depend on the virtualization as much, right?
As much as we do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so. Alright,
I thought that the problem with the modeling, the hardest part of the modeling is that what are the influencing parameters? That is really hard because we need to identify the parameters that actually changes the application performance, that may change the application performance. That is the hardest part.
So what type of parameter did you come up with?
I guess in the last, I ended with 5 parameters.
What are they specifically?
I guess CPU, of course, because you know the cap thing that you can vary the CPU. Then I guess the memory, of course.
So these are the resource parameters.
Resource parameters of the VM of each for a single VM.
Okay.
IO9.
Okay.
That's for the IO. Then you have IO from other domains.
Okay.
Because you know that VM IO is actually dependent on the other IO. The competing IOs from all the other domains.
First
domain. That we need to take care of. I think we said it is 4 in the end. But that's still not clear because we found that still there are some conflicting problems with the
services. Did you mean that they're not linearly independent?
No, that's the problem.
Mm.
Because one parameter may depend on other parameters.
Yeah, so, okay. So you could, okay.
So by the way, I mean, about that work, recently I've been reading up on some statistics, and this is sort of a very standard problem that statisticians need to always continuously solve, which is given a set of parameters, and given a set of independent parameters, determine a model that fits the influence of those independent parameters on a dependent parameter.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a whole bunch of different techniques in that space. And I guess what we are looking at is a neural network kind of model, which is just one class of models. And so
you are suggesting that it may be good to compare with any other model?
So for instance, I mean, regression is.
Yeah, but
even in linear regression, there is a whole bunch of different variants in regression. Yeah, because of how the parameters influence the dependent parameter. There are very standardized procedures for when you have a given set of parameters that you have no idea how they influence the dependent parameter, to determine first of all which are the real parameters that influence
the output.
The output. And so there are things like basic things like correlation between the input parameters themselves. If there is highly correlated parameters, then maybe only one of them should be used, not both. Also, there is one class of regression models, which is best subset regression, which basically increases the set of parameters in the model given us. So let's say you have 100 parameters. You don't know which ones influence the target parameter. You can give this best subset regression model a number, say 15. Give me the best 15 parameters if I want to use only 15 parameters. And then this best subset regression will also will allow you to tell you what is the correct number of parameters that should be used, and of these number of parameters, which of the parameters actually fall and build a model at that number. So if it says in the end, well, you should be using not 15, you should be using 45 parameters, and here are those 45 parameters that form the best subset for this regression model. So this is just one class of regression that I just got. There are several such classes of regression models that statisticians have come up with, and which could be potentially relevant.
I think Kokoshi may be able to
tell
us more about the regression.
And I think, I mean, if especially if we want to go along these lines, which is, you know, modeling and performance validation, then knowing some statistics is really to our benefit. Then
actually,
we can make more scientific claims.
It's not the first time we end up saying that we need more statistical knowledge, right?
Yeah.
I think we should all take the course in statistics. Probably a tutorial, I mean, gather someday or once or twice a week and study statistics.
Each one of us could do like a topic and next them to the
others. It's probably with the modeling stuff.
Well,
we can all see the video of the
the what?
The
classes.
Classes that you can.
What were you?
The class.
There's also an electronic text that Giri forwarded to me. So he sent me a pointer to an online statistics text, which is actually reasonable for computer scientists to read, because some of the statistics texts are just out of the, you know, they're way beyond the scope of a computer scientist, because there's just too much math in there.
Is there a way we can take an statistics course?
Yeah, but we can. But I mean, I don't know how to do that, because
But you need to find a.
But you need a permission or something like that. Because according to the department website, you can only take specific courses either from the computer science department or from.
I think you can take any graduate level courses.
Yeah.
I think graduate level is probably okay. The one that you were initially investigating was an undergraduate writing course, right? English. Who was that? You were the one who was technical writing. I think undergraduate courses are a little bit of a problem, but I think graduate courses you should be able to take.
But even from any department.
Yeah.
But if you're taking a graduate course of the statistics, I think it would not be of much help.
Yeah.
Because
of what you said, it would be like reading the statistics book.
But can we take it, you know, offline, just talk to a professor?
You can say, well, I'm a computer science student. Some professors will say, no, you cannot sit in my class. Others will say, well, no, I have no problems. Come and sit.
Of course.
Except that you don't bother me with too many questions and disrupt the class.
Is that true?
They will probably say that, because if you're at a different level than the rest of the students and you're keeping the class behind and you're not even paying for it, then they may have a problem with that. But some professors may be even cool with that, so you just need to find out ahead of time what they are okay with.
I guess it's a good time, because, you know, we're about to start our new semester.
I think having statistics will help you, especially, I mean, in storage work, I think we certainly need some. I will forward you that, Is that, I briefly, you know, reviewed that, and it seemed like
something that I could handle. So yeah. So I think it would be useful. I'll forward you that.
Yeah. Also like the idea of the future. We can talk about some topics.
Yes, probably we can do something like that next semester.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, we're like a big group. So. But we are five people.
Yeah, so one person does one topic per week. That's fine.
Mm.
Yeah,
but you're talking about the presentation?
So I would let one of you organize that, the statistics part.
Probably said you. No, really.
Yeah.
Really,
but my work is more related.
Exactly.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, you need to do a little bit of planning to find out what are the sources and how to sequentially progress.
And what are the
relevant
topics that make a progress?
What?
Like make a...
No.
Like what topics are relevant to us?
Find out how many grades.
But I guess modeling would be, I mean, something like...
Yeah. Statistical modeling, right?
Yeah.
And certainly, I mean, I would encourage you, Sajeev, especially you, to see if you can find a statistics, undergrad statistics class, and introductory statistics class.
That is the online EMU class statistics. But I don't know how
it's called.
That looks
like an undergrad
class.
Yeah, but I don't know how relevant
it is. But
that's, is that good? I don't know.
But
the OLI.
Okay, so are we done here?
So do you have any
my ideas?
Yeah.
I have several ideas, so I don't know if I should...
No, I think you should. Just to, you know...
The goal of these sessions, I thought, was to get you guys to... or rather force you to think of new ideas. And I have several things that I would like us to work on, but I mean, for instance, I did mention to Medha about the reliable disk project, that is one. I think in storage there are still some important problems that need to be solved. What I've been doing in the last 2 weeks at least is to just understand I/O workloads much better by looking at all the traces that we have collected so far and analyzing those workloads. And some of the findings I think I should share with you guys, which is that, so we traced, Ricardo was the one who was doing all the traces. So he basically traced several different workloads. So he traced two virtual machines, which are our production, online.cs.fiu.edu and webmail.cs. So Eric actually agreed us to get those traces. So he traced those two machines. And then he traced our mail server, which is Cheetah, which serves all the inboxes, the entire department, all the students, faculty, and staff. So we traced that. Then I think he traced some of your desktops,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was to, you know, just to identify content similarity in these workloads. But looking at these workloads, you can do all kinds of analysis now that we have access to these workloads. And some of the high-level bullets I can tell you of what I found.
The trace is the block level.
It's block-level trace, yeah. I'll tell you the high bullets, and then you can go and think about how you can use these high bullets or the findings to come up with new ideas. And, okay, so the first thing is that the amount of write IOs was more than an order of magnitude compared to the read IOs.
all of these machines, except the homes of you guys or the desktop workloads that I haven't gotten a chance to analyze yet. But online, webmail, Cheetah, the mail servers, and I guess this was, I haven't looked at the traces that we did for Borg. I don't remember what exactly was the statistics, but I think in the paper we have unique reads and unique writes, and the total reads and total writes as well.
Yeah.
I don't know how the statistics, did they match up with the ones that I'm quoting right now. Probably do.
I think it's not.
But this is very interesting. I mean, most of the traffic is writes. Okay, so the amount of writes, order of magnitude greater than the amount of reads, but the amount of unique reads is an order of magnitude greater than the amount of unique writes, which means the unique locations on disk. So this was,
you're always doing the same thing.
You're always writing the same location. Yeah, exactly. So you have very interesting behavior that the total, if you just look at the total volume of the writes, it's order of magnitude greater than the total volume of the reads. But if you look at only the unique locations to which writes are targeted versus unique locations to which reads are targeted, reads are order of magnitude more than writes. So.
And all of those have the same kind of file systems.
I think they're all journaling file systems, which may indicate something to some extent, but I also went and found out about typical journal size. Journal size typically by default in EXT3 is 128 megabytes. But it is, can be changed.
128
megabytes, which is really, really small. That is the size of the journal, default EXT3 journal. I don't know if the recent versions have changed that or not. But that was something interesting. I think the most heavily loaded workload was the mail server, and in a span of 1 week, there were almost 1 terabyte of total IOs to that server, and of which more than 90% was write traffic. So there's a whole bunch of writing going on to be.
But that's just because you trace the actual machine and not the contents, right?
Not the content, yeah. So I did content similarity analysis.
No, I don't mean content similarity. I mean you trace the machine that was servicing the request, not the ones where the homes where the content was stored. The web pages were stored. You trace the machine that was running Apache.
Well, that is true for the online and webmail.
Okay.
For the online and webmail, the data was not being. The actual data that was retrieved was not being tracked. But for the mail, it was all data inclusive. Even then, the writes were an order of magnitude greater than the reads, which was, for me, completely surprising.
And what kind of machines are
they? Probably they have more.
Are they RAID?
It's probably caching, that most of the reads are actually serviced out of the cache.
So only the unique reads are going.
So only the misses are going to the disk. The write,
so
writes have to go to disk.
One question. They're using VMware ESX.
Not ESX. They are using VMware Workstation.
Workstation.
The free version.
The free version.
Well, ESX, you have to pay money for.
No, but ESX. I think it's free.
Oh yeah. ESX is now free, right?
Yeah.
So maybe they are the ESXi. ESXi is
not. I guess they even changed.
I don't know if they changed though. Yeah, because they were using Workstation, and this has been a machine that's deployed.
No, I was just asking because
server. Workstation is paid. Probably the server is the one that's.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
The VMware server is the one free. The VMware Workstation is paid.
No,
yeah.
There was a free VMware.
No, it's server the one that's paid.
Now maybe, right. Perhaps now that is the case. The ESX server was not free for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's only free in the last 2 or 3 months.
No. I mean, there's two different ones. ESX has been freed for some small amount of time, but VMware Server, that's the one that Louis is talking about.
Oh, VMware Server.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's probably what they're using.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, it's not workstation.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that means that they are running Linux.
They are running?
Linux on Linux. And that's where Ricardo is tracing that.
No, I think Ricardo's tracing inside the VM.
The VM.
Inside the individual VM. Mm-hmm. So there is a layer of indirection below these traces that's going on that we haven't taken into account.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, it does matter if you're using a file back cache. So.
But it, in terms of workload, it doesn't matter.
The workload is.
No, I'm saying that it would matter if you're using a file back virtual log device, then you have a huge cache that's inside the VMM itself. So you'll see even fewer reads than you saw.
Yeah, but he's tracing the VM.
Yes, he's tracing the VM, but if you trace the actual workload to the disk, then you would see even fewer
reads to the
disk. So it is somewhat of a approximate trace from a disk standpoint. But it's still okay, I guess. It would be exactly the same if you used disk-backed virtual block device, because then there would be no cache underneath. And then whatever goes to the virtual block device will be also going to the physical block device. Mm-hmm. So these are a couple of observations. The other observation is that working set overlap. So the way I computed the working sets is exactly the same as we did for Borg, which is you take all the unique accesses on every day and say, okay, how does the unique axes overlap with the unique axes of the previous day or the unique axes of day one? So there are two variants. One is long-term and short.
The interval goes one day.
So I also examined multi-day intervals. So one-day intervals and three-day intervals and one-week intervals. So I looked at all of these interval sizes. And for some workloads, like the online and webmail, if you take one-day intervals, the overlaps are around 40%, something like that. But as soon as you go into three-day intervals, it's more than 90%. You look at 1 week, it's more than 95%. It means that 95% of the blocks that you're accessing every week is overlapping with the blocks that you accessed in the previous week. And then...
That's in terms of rank.
That in terms of all IOs. And then so I separated it out into reads and writes and saw read overlaps.
And for the reads, the unique reads, what is the interval that they're unique?
What do you mean?
Like,
so in each interval, regardless of the size of the interval, you identify all the unique blocks.
No, it's within the interval.
Within that interval, yes. And then you see how much do they overlap with the previous. But I do see a point, which is there are two parameters in here. One is the size of the history, and then the size of the current working set. Yeah, I do agree. But in this case, they are both the same. So in the read case, it turns out that for some workloads, the reads are much worse than if you take the whole thing. So if you take the writes and the reads, the overlaps are substantially smaller than if you take both. So, and that's obvious because if you look at unique accesses, the writes are going to the same location, and if you take the writes as part of the working set, you'll have much greater overlap, right? So, but if you just look at the reads, there is not as much overlap, especially even if you look across 3 day and 1 week intervals, the read overlaps are only around 40 to 50% rather than 90 and 95% if you would take everything.
So you said that there's an order of magnitude more writes than reads.
There is an order of magnitude more write volume than read volume. But the unique writes is...
Yeah, but then doesn't... I mean, then most of those rights are not necessarily to journals. Because if they were to journals, there would be at least as much read as write, or maybe half as read as write. You would, because for each write to for each two rights to a journal, you do one read. Because you have to read. I mean, you write to a journal, then you read it back, and you write it to the other place. Right, so you
you don't read, especially with a 128 megabyte journal size. Your data is already in memory when you want to checkpoint, so you don't need to read again. And that's the whole point of having a small journal, is that when you do checkpointing, the data that you need to do the checkpointing is resides in memory at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't reread from the journal and write it out. On the other hand, if you have a much larger journal size, when you do checkpointing, data may not be available in memory. And I think that's one of the reasons for why you want to have a small journal size, so that your checkpointing overhead is reduced.
So you're accounting the journal price as well?
Yes, all right.
Mm-hmm.
All
so
right.
In the checkpointing, you just need to read the descriptor block.
Yeah, but I have to say that even in that case, most of the writes are not to journals. Most of the writes are actually to static locations, because the unique writes, what I found was of the order of 3 to 5 gigabytes,
and that
should be much larger than the journal size. It is 128 megabytes.
I guess you're doing order mode, which means that most of the data can go to
static locations.
So what about the swap?
What about the swap?
Are those right to swap?
That I'm not sure of. I haven't looked at the process information. So the swapper thread is which one? It's not...
Isn't the case swap the idle process?
Oh, swapper. Okay. That's the one I saw. And I think the reason was that most of the IOs were actually swapper IOs, because the way Ricardo wrote this module, instead of earlier he was recording both read issuing as well as read completion. He realized that the traces were becoming too large, so he only started reporting read completion.
And of course not, so you don't have any process.
No, there is no process context for reads.
Oh, of course.
It's all swapper. So.
But if you have the partition information, you could find out.
No, it's still very hard. Well, for swap, you could,
yes.
but not for.
Well, take on the process.
The other
one. It's true. Yeah, so there is a lot of analysis to be done, and you know, what I would like to do is to make all my scripts available to you guys, so that you can, you know, play with this data, and because you can extend some of the scripts to do more interesting analysis. What I have is very, I would say, primitive, and this is the, you know, this I want to create a project about workload analysis. And I think it is something which is definitely worth publishing, especially if we have production traces like we do, but we need much more of that. We need longer term traces, and we need...
So are those traces still being collected?
So I've asked Eric to let us collect those traces indefinitely.
Indefinitely?
Yeah. So we can have even year-long traces.
So where are we storing them?
We are storing them in Eric's storage for the time being, and he has...
I guess it's not...
Ricardo is always worried of, you know, that... key run out of space.
Yeah, but I mean, storage is cheap. So far, Ricardo has only managed to collect 1 terabyte worth of traces within the span of 1.5 months. So he has 1 terabyte.
I guess 500 gigabytes.
1 year, right? Yeah. I mean, unless we start collecting a whole bunch of new servers, we should be okay in terms of storage. I don't think Eric was really concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem is actually processing these traces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now, so initially for the toy traces we had, 1 week traces, it was fine. I mean, I would wait for an hour and I would have the results. But when now the volume of the traces are 100x larger.
100x.
100x larger than what we dealt with Borg and...
In what language are you doing
this? Bash.
Bash, yeah.
Bash, awk.
That could be a problem.
Yeah.
What?
That could be a problem.
Yeah.
Very slow. I guess we have to speak.
Yeah, I guess writing it in C would probably speed it up. But the main problem was to make it multi-threaded. So I finally changed all my scripts to multi-threaded version. So now I can actually run, I got access to a machine which we have here, which has 16 CPUs and 128 gigabytes of memory. And so I made my scripts multi-threaded and I start doing my analysis. All my threads are running at 1% CPU utilization. So I realized that that's because all the files are on NFS on some volume.
Oh,
so I had to move 1 terabyte to local disk on that machine. And then they started going at more reasonable CPU utilizations. So that's why I actually managed to analyze a whole bunch of traces over this weekend. So I had to do it all multi-threaded and do it all local storage. And finally, it makes some sense. But I was thinking, as I'm doing all these analysis, I think it's worth writing a paper about all of this.
Definitely.
To actually, you know, we are looking at not just unique data location access characteristics, but also content. So I was doing exactly the same analysis. Instead of looking at LVA, I'm looking at the content that's being stored, and to see how much repetition there is in content.
What is the repetition?
I guess that one takes longer.
What?
I guess that one takes longer than the other one. Or no, because
it does take a little bit longer, but it's not a whole lot because.
Yeah, because actually you don't have the content. You just have a hash.
Yeah, it's just hashes.
Okay.
So I did some analysis, but I don't have anything which is a trend that I can share with you yet.
Mm.
But yeah, hopefully within the next week I'll have more data that I can share with you.
Yeah,
but I'm hoping that we'll be able to, you know, start collecting more traces with, especially with the online and web mail. Those are reasonable traces to look at, but they are only looking at, like Josh pointed out, local OS and Apache IOs, but not actual content retrievals, because all that content is, you know, is mounted by NFS. So if I'm monitoring local disk, I won't see any of that stuff.
So
So those NFS volumes are sitting on some virtualized server that's running Xen. So, and Ricardo recently managed to test his stuff with Xen VMM. So I think we can ask Eric to start tracing that host as well. And that host, I think, has a whole bunch of storage attached to it. And that's serving a whole bunch of web content for various web servers that are running on different VMs across different hosts. So it's sort of like a SAN-like environment.
What about the users and homes?
The user homes...
That one will have a lot of activity.
Problem is that user homes are on a Solaris machine.
Yeah. Oh, so you have to do detrace.
Yeah, we have to do detrace or something like that instead of what we have with Linux. So user homes cannot be traced. So at least for the time being.
So, well, I guess one question would be why Ricardo developed his own trace instead of using block trace.
Why did he develop his own traces? I think the main was that block trace does not support content hashes.
Okay. Well, I guess that's easy to add.
So if you think it's easy to add, I think we should be using that because the problem is that Ricardo's module right now gives us only partial information and doesn't give us a lot of important information. Especially process context is critical to have. For read operations, and we don't have that. And also, if you just report completion times, you don't know the order in which they were issued, so you cannot replay traces, and that becomes a problem, or at least accurately replay traces.
Yeah, because, you know, for instance, with that traces you have, we cannot have B2C times.
Yeah, we cannot have that stuff, so...
Actually, you can have any time.
So, it's really geared. So, the kind of analysis that I'm doing, it's fine to do it with the Ricardo spaces.
Okay.
But if we want to do more interesting analysis, then we need something much more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we need something like block trace.
You know, if the Solaris machines, they have their support G-trace.
That I'm not sure of. I don't know which version of Solaris they are running and
but
if they ever upgraded it.
Because I remember Ricardo was doing something in D3 some time ago.
For damage?
Yeah, but he was complaining that D3 is really bad.
I think it's all a question of the learning curve.
No, because, no, his point was that apparently if you do an if for a while, then he says that the module is unstable. And he said that Eric would not accept to load something that...
Who said that module is unstable?
D-trace, mark that thing is unstable. If you do an if or a while.
Whoa.
So, yeah, so basically...